somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 27. How Enlightening. After a short stint in the present with our two Oslo Freedom Forum specials, we're back where we left the general history last time, or rather where we left off after episode 20 on the Seeds of the Enlightenment. For after having tracked the development of free speech in 18th century America, we're headed back to ground zero of the Enlightenment in Europe. There's just no way I can do justice to this seminal era of European history and all the events and characters who played a part in shaping them. And as already mentioned in episode 20, historians and political philosophers differ sharply on when and where the Enlightenment or Enlightenment took place. Even today, many people disagree profoundly on how to judge the legacy of the Enlightenment and so-called Enlightenment values. But whatever the exact nature and consequences of the Enlightenment, that this period had a profound impact on the principles and practice of free speech, censorship, and tolerance is hardly debatable. But those developments were unevenly distributed across Europe and often much more conflicting and less principled than what many imagine. So to give you a flavor of just how differently things played out across 18th century Europe, I plan on releasing a number of episodes focusing on different regions and themes, culminating with the French Revolution and its immediate aftermath. But before we dig in, it might be a good idea to take stock and look back on some of the major events that we've covered so far leading up to the Enlightenment, and also map out some of the themes and countries we'll be visiting in the following episode. So this episode aims to briefly set the scene and prepare the ground for the following episodes, rather than consist of the usual deep dive into the specifics. As we'll see in the following episodes, many Enlightenment thinkers disagreed on fundamental issues, including the permissible limits of free speech. But if we're to highlight two themes underlying the Enlightenment and its principal thinkers from Scotland to Russia, it was an emphasis on rationality and secularization at the expense of theology and tradition. Before 1650, the major European fault line was confessional. And as we've seen, this confessional dividing line between the mainline sects of Catholics, Lutherans, Reformed and Anglicans was often brutally policed, with dissenters of all stripes paying a heavy price. But a number of developments, including the devastating effects of the Thirty Years' War, the advent of Cartesian philosophy, Newtonian science, and the emergence of a public sphere, infused Europe with skepticism towards blindly accepting the doctrines of revealed religion, the authority of the clergy, or the reality of magic, hell, and miracles that previous Europeans took for granted. It was not that most Europeans became non-believers. Atheism was still widely condemned as both immoral and destructive. But in the words of Margaret Jacob, religion in general was becoming more private than public, more individual than collective, and thoughts rather than ornate ceremonies began to define the believer. So in the Age of Enlightenment, increasingly the question was no longer which sect's orthodoxy to believe in, but whether to believe in orthodoxy at all. To quote an unnerved English publicist in 1713.
Now religion in general is the question. Religion is the thing stabbed at. The controversy now is whether there ought to be any form of religion on earth, or whether there be any God in heaven.
Another accompanying fundamental change that Europe underwent from 1650 and a century onwards was towards more religious tolerance and freedom of conscience. That marks an important contrast to the Europe we witnessed in many of the last 20 episodes, and which for long was a persecuting society where, at its most extreme, people were burned for baptizing adults or questioning the Trinity. Tolerance long remained what's been called a loser's creed, and thinkers like Sebastian Castellio risked their lives when criticizing religious intolerance. The religious violence exploded during the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, culminating in a devastating 30 Years' War. But from the early Enlightenment, states generally became less obsessed with militantly enforcing strict confessionalism in which the citizens had to adopt the same religion as their ruler. In France, Louis XIV sent tens of thousands of Huguenots packing when he revoked the Edict of Nantes in 1685. But things changed for the better when the Sun King died in 1750, so much so that some warned that toleration had gone too far. Even absolute monarchs like Prussia's Frederick the Great, who became pen pal with Voltaire, Russia's Peter and Catherine the Great, and Austria's Joseph II found sound, rational reasons to tolerate religious minorities and turn them into profitable assets instead of bitter enemies. "All must be tolerated," proclaimed Frederick in 1740, the year he assumed the throne. "Here, everyone must be allowed to choose his own road to salvation." Of course, as we'll see in a future episode, the reality wasn't always as clear-cut. But even in strictly confessional Spain, the 18th century, with some delay, also saw a marked drop in the already declining number of arrests and executions by the Inquisition, which had been sapped of much of its energy. Of course, we should not exaggerate the level of tolerance. As we've seen, Catholics, Jews, and Socinians were accepted by the Toleration Act in England, nor were Socinians kosher even in the Dutch Republic. But in most countries, cleansing the land of heresy and heretics and ensuring strict orthodoxy in religious observance fell out of fashion. The practice, though more rarely the principle, of free speech was central to this development. In the words of historian Jonathan Israel,
"No major cultural transformation in Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire displayed anything comparable to the impressive cohesion of European intellectual culture in the late 17th and early 18th century. For it was then that Western and Central Europe first became, in the sphere of ideas, broadly a single arena integrated by mostly newly invented channels of communication, ranging from newspapers, magazines, and the salon to the coffee shop, and a whole array of fresh cultural devices, of which the erudite journals and the universal library were particularly crucial."
This development hacked away at the pillars of tradition and authority, both religious and political. One set of dogmas had been held up to the skeptical light of rational investigation. Some in the most radical camp were unwilling to accept any dogma on the basis of authority, tradition, revealed religion, miracles, or other explanations irreconcilable with new scientific methods and philosophical inquiry. Again, Margaret Jacob is illuminating. She states that these radicals
started by criticizing the abuses of theocratic clergy and absolutist kings, and then they did not know where to stop.
Europe's princes, rulers, churches, and bigwigs had themselves helped germinate the Enlightenment by amassing ever larger libraries of books, including forbidden books by materialist deists and even atheist philosophers. Some of these libraries were private. The Danish Count Otto Tutt had a private library that included 120,000 volumes, including one of the most extensive collections of radical and forbidden books of the early 18th century. These collections of learning would set off uncontrollable intellectual chain reactions, and the ideological fallout would prove to have a very long half-life that allowed ideas to adapt and mutate before the original ones had run their course or been banned from the marketplace of ideas. Moreover, the learning available in public and private libraries was discussed and disseminated in periodical journals like L'Europe Savante from 1718. And as we've already seen in previous episodes, such journals would be available in coffee houses and salons where free discussion was encouraged and cultivated. The importance of the spread of books, knowledge, and forums for discussion for the breakthrough of the Enlightenment is also relevant for discussions in our own age. Every human being with an internet connection has access to infinitely more knowledge than Count Otto Tutt had amassed by spending a fortune that only the tiniest fraction of those alive on the planet in the early 18th century could afford. But per June 2019, there were some 3.4 million e-books available on Amazon, to which you can add millions of print books. On Script, you get access to 60 million plus documents and counting, including hundreds of thousands of e- and audiobooks. That's three times the amount of all the books printed in 1790. And if your focus is more specialist and academic, you can get access to more than 2,000 journals in the humanities, social, and natural sciences through JSTOR. Add to this countless other online libraries, some of them entirely free, offered by public and private institutions such as universities. And suddenly you have a powerful corrective to the prevalent techno-dystopia and lament about the insidious effects of the internet, typically espoused by learned people in countries where access to just about all the available knowledge of mankind is taken for granted and is only a few clicks away, whether sat at your desk, traveling, or sipping cortados. What the almost total democratization of knowledge and information means for the future of mankind is yet to be seen. But surely we should not categorically rule out new enlightenments rather than inevitable decay. The gradual entrenchment of a more secularist and rationalist outlook was a key driver of the increasing religious tolerance across the continent, although this commitment, as I said, was far from universal, consistent, or principled. Even more important for this podcast is debunking the popular idea that increasing tolerance of religious diversity also led to tolerance of diversity of ideas and speech in general. While religious tolerance and freedom of speech are surely interrelated and mutually beneficial, the development from religious tolerance to freedom of thought and expression was neither automatic or straightforward. We've already seen that the advance of religious tolerance or even religious freedom in American colonies like Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Rhode Island did not translate into freedom of speech, and that colonists who were unmolested for their religious dissent were punished, sometimes brutally, when they openly questioned, mocked, or criticized the political authorities. William Penn, having a Pennsylvania colonist whipped for seditious libel, is perhaps the most powerful image of the disconnect between religious freedom and freedom of speech at the time. So openly rejecting the twin pillars of religion and authority, seen as indispensable for a well-ordered and virtuous society, very much remained beyond the pale. Consequently, censorship aimed its focus on the radical, blasphemous, and seditious ideas of the early Enlightenment that eroded these pillars and threatened to replace them with nothing but the fickleness of human reason and irreligion. In fact, many of those who welcomed a more rationalist understanding of the universe and human nature agreed that going too far down the road of rationalism and secularization was like flicking the switch of a doomsday clock. So you'll remember that even the so-called grandfather of liberalism, John Locke, thought it dangerous to tolerate atheists. Ever since Gutenberg invented his printing press, which Luther exploited to the fullest, as we covered in episode 10, we've seen churches and rulers fighting a tough battle with books and pamphlets. Book burnings, bookshop raids, border inspection, pre-publication censorship, and indices of forbidden books were the order of the day. But at the end of the day, the number of books and pamphlets just kept growing. And the Enlightenment did not bring a stop to censorship, but it profoundly changed its nature. The most striking feature of censorship in the late 17th and early 18th century was that it passed from ecclesiastical authorities and churches to the secular hands of the state. And, with time, this took place in both Catholic and Protestant Europe. Consequently, censors redirected their attention from heresy to corrosive philosophy as well as obscenity and eroticism and sedition. It should perhaps not surprise us that an absolutist ruler like Russia's Catherine the Great declared freedom of religion with one hand while executing seditious authors and sending disobedient serfs to lifetime labor in Siberia, or that her predecessor, the secular enlightened despot Peter the Great, built schools, museums, printing presses, and newspapers with one hand, while with the other he tortured his political enemies, banned writing behind locked doors, and dictated how to shave and dress. But even the liberal Dutch Republic found some ideas too radical to stomach. As we saw in episode 20, the epicenter of the early Enlightenment was the Dutch Republic, home or refuge of René Descartes, Baruch Spinoza, Pierre Bayle, and John Locke, as well as being the newspaper and printing hub of Europe at the time, from where illegal books were smuggled past the walls of censorship erected in most other European countries. not least France, from where Protestant Huguenots like Bale had fled in large numbers to the Dutch Republic after the Sun King's revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685. In much of Europe, the clandestine Dutch printing presses and networks of diffusion were thought of much like we think of the dark web today. A lawless black hole of filth, crime, and sedition, undermining law and order and corrupting essential institutions. By 1700, the fictitious publisher Pierre Marteau, an imprint invented by anonymous French radicals in the Dutch Republic to fool censors in France and the rest of Europe, had published upwards of 300 books in a total of some 150,000 copies. These books criticized Catholicism, the Sun King, and evolved into ever more daring philosophy and erotic novels. No one took more advantage of the comparably liberal Dutch climate, and no one had a larger impact on radical Enlightenment ideology than the Dutch Jewish philosopher Baruch Spinoza, whom we covered in a separate expert opinion with Professor Stephen Nadler in episode 19, as well as in episode 20. In Spinoza's controversial political theological treatise from 1670, Spinoza called for libertas philosophandi, the freedom to philosophize. Not only the freedom to believe in whatever you wanted, but the right to reject all revealed religion and discuss all controversial matters of politics and philosophy. These values, not enforced religious or political orthodoxy, were the essential building blocks of a free and pluralistic republic. And Spinoza set his own powerful example by dissecting the Bible itself with his critical pen, causing enraged critics to condemn his treatise as a book forged in hell by the devil himself. The political theological treatise tipped the famous Dutch tolerance past the breaking point, and the treatise was formally banned in 1674, while several other laws were passed aimed at suppressing Spinozistic texts in general over the next years, essentially banning Spinozism as such. You'll also remember that a member of Spinoza's circle, Adrian Korbach, died in prison convicted of blasphemy under the strict anti-Socinian laws. At least on Spinoza, Catholics and Protestants could see eye to eye, and so the theological political treatise was also put on the index of prohibited books by the Catholic Church in 1679. Call it ecumenical censorship. But the Pandora's box of materialist thinking and natural religion had been opened, and the Dutch dark web ensured the spread of Spinoza's works far and wide. And much like the algorithms of YouTube recommends increasingly extreme and controversial videos once you start binging, so the users of the Dutch dark web further radicalized Spinoza's already radical ideas. In the early 18th century, the anonymous treatise of the three impostors, falsely attributed to Spinoza to attract virality, started circulating in manuscript form. This anonymous treatise took aim at organized religion as such and then let fly without reserve. The whole idea of organized religion was sustained by vain and ridiculous opinions coupled with ignorance. It also claimed that there are no such thing in nature as either God or devil or soul or heaven or hell. And the three central figures of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, were nothing but frauds.
The apparitions and the conferrings of Moses and Mahomet, like the divine origin of Jesus, are the greatest impostures which anyone has been able to hatch and which you should flee if you love the truth.
Theologians and the clergy weren't spared either.
These men who exhibit and spread about ridiculous fables for sacred truths divinely revealed are all of them, except some few ignorant dunces, people of villainous principles who maliciously abuse and impose on the credulous populace.
The text was too shocking to find an actual printer before 1719. And obviously, censors across the continent fought vigorously to search and destroy the three impostors, and only a few contemporary copies survive. Based on modern literary and archival detective work, Margaret Jacob offers the Dutch lawyer Jan Froese as the probable author of the treatise, with the Amsterdam-based Huguenot Frenchman and Freemason Jean Rousseau de Missy and the bookseller Charles Levier was involved too. As we shall see in a later episode, the radical materialist algorithm created by Spinoza and shared on the Dutch dark web by his followers would radicalize further and find fertile ground in France, where a coterie of Enlightenment thinkers and philosophers took the last step into outright atheism that shocked even a skeptic like David Hume. But it was not only the erosion of the role of revealed religion that shocked traditionalists. Women also gained a more prominent public role, and sex became a topic of discussion rather than universal shame, at least among some. For women and other disenfranchised groups, the Enlightenment was an important step towards the modern world. When radical thinkers began to separate religion from morality, it allowed them to question the relationship between men and women and the supposedly naturally inferior status of the latter, and thereby sow the first seeds of universal human rights, feminism, and modern democracy. One of the first European thinkers to suggest this crazy idea was the Dutch spinozist Adrian Beveland. As a classicist, he was a big fan of outspoken Romans like Ovid and Catullus, who taught him that women are just as sexual as men, and that the notion of female chastity was both a prison and a scam. Needless to say, his works caused a great scandal in the late 17th century. Beveland was fined heavily, sacked from the university, and banned from the provinces of Holland and Zeeland, while the South Holland Synod condemned his most popular book as a foul and blasphemous treatise. Of course, the rights of women should not be measured by the writings of a man, especially not one who was punished for his proto-feminism. But the new winds created a social sphere where at least some women could mingle more freely with men and participate in discussions, enjoying what Jonathan Israel calls conversational freedom. Women started appearing in clubs, Masonic lodges, and salons where science, philosophy, and politics were discussed intensely. And even if women were often merely the organizers of salon events, they could wield huge influence. And some, like Lady Mary Wortley Montagu and later Mary Wollstonecraft, became public intellectuals in their own right. One of the most significant events of the French Revolution, which we'll cover in a future episode, was thousands of women marching on Versailles in October 1789, demanding equal rights. In spite of all this, the National Assembly didn't regard women as equal citizens in their supposed-to-be Universal Declaration of the Rights of Men. This prompted the female philosopher and playwright Olympe de Gouges to draft her own Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen. Though, as we shall see, things did not end well for de Gouges. On sex, several scandalous novels outraged traditionalists in the 18th century, not least Thérèse Philosophe from 1748. In Thérèse Philosophe, a young nun undergoes a journey of emancipation from her strictly and religiously regimented life through a pretty explosive cocktail of philosophy, masturbation, sexual curiosity, erotic literature, and ultimately extramarital sex, which leads her to become a philosopher herself and abandoning organized religion. Hardly the chaste and quietly submissive female role model envisaged by traditionalists. Even if censorship was revamped, secularized, and remained the norm in most of the 18th century, the differences in severity of censorship seems to have contributed to both the scale of production and consumption of books in different European states. The two Dutch economic historians, L. Jo Boerink and Jan Luiten van Santen, have produced a complex and elaborate estimate of the development in book production and consumption in Western Europe from the fall of the Western Roman Empire until the end of the 18th century. The estimate should be treated with a good deal of caution due to the uncertainty of the underlying data. For one, it doesn't seem to include the prohibited books circulated clandestinely on the Dutch and later French dark web. But it may still serve as a useful helicopter view of the book production and consumption in the biggest Western European states in the 18th century. Of course, many factors are in play when determining why book production and consumption was higher in some countries than in others, and why numbers fluctuated over time. For one, the Reformation, with its emphasis on direct access to the Bible and the Word of God, tended to favor literacy and reading in Protestant countries. Whereas the Catholic Church's vigorous Counter-Reformation banned the translation of the Bible into the vernacular and prevented Catholics from reading the sacred text of their own faith. In Italy, inhabitants were even prohibited from reading as such, lest they be led astray. Openness to trade, economic status, and per capita income are surely also important factors. But while the two authors fail to even mention the word, and much less the possible effects of censorship, it does not seem like a coincidence that the two most liberal states, the Dutch Republic and Great Britain, also kept a solid first and second place in terms of book production and consumption. According to the estimates by Boering and Van Zanden, the Dutch printing houses churned out close to 41 million books and pamphlets between 1701 and 1750. That's an impressive feat for such a small state, rivaling much larger Italy and beating Spain by a factor of four. And per capita, Dutch book production simply had no competition between 1600 and 1800. From episode 20, you may also remember the Reformed minister lamenting that the Dutch were more interested in reading newspapers than Bibles. Well, reading books was popular too. Despite the ban against Spinoza and Spinoza's ideas, the Dutch on average consumed some 392 books per 1,000 inhabitants every year between 1701 and 1750. That's twice the number in Britain, almost seven times the number in France, 21 times the number in Spain, and more than 80 times the number in Russia, Austria, and my own country, Denmark. Countries which were Orthodox, Catholic, and Lutheran respectively, but all shared a tight regime of censorship. Great Britain also played a prominent role and became the world's leading producer of books and pamphlets. Between 1751 and 1800, the British bookshops churned out more than 138 million books. And as the second freest society in terms of press freedom, Britain also kept a fitting second place in terms of book consumption per capita until overtaken by the dark horse of Sweden. Authors like Jonathan Swift and Daniel Defoe tempted the British into consuming an annual 168 books per 1,000 Britons. Less than half the number in the Netherlands, but still far ahead of most of Europe. You'll remember that British censorship was reduced to a shadow of its former self when the Toleration Act was passed in 1689, and especially when the Licensing Act was repealed in 1695, a decision in which John Locke played a vital role, pulling the strings behind the scenes. And interestingly, Locke pointed to the Dutch Republic and its higher quantity and superior quality of books as an argument against the private licensing regime of the stationer's company. But post-publication censorship didn't disappear, and only in 1698, the Blasphemy Act made it illegal to deny the Holy Trinity. And in 1710, the House of Commons ordered the works of Matthew Tindal burned by the hangman. As late as 1704, David Hume felt the need to censor himself and scrap a controversial chapter on miracles from his Treatise of Human Nature. And of course, seditious libel laws continued to be part and parcel of the common law, as elucidated in William Blackstone's commentary, which distinguished sharply between pre-publication censorship, an unacceptable encroachment of liberty, and post-publication punishments, an indispensable protection against licentiousness. Though, as we've seen, criminal seditious libel laws became an almost dead letter in British America after the Sanger case in 1735. Sweden fooled everyone and jumped from sixth to second place in terms of average book consumption. Thanks to a new governmental policy, literacy rates exploded and the demand for books went through the roof. Consumption more than trebled from an annual 58.5 per 1,000 Swedes in the late 17th century to 209 in the late 18th. I hate to admit it, but the average Swede consumed almost 12 times as many books as the average Dane. Of course, this did not mean that the Swedes were strangers to censorship. In a speech at Uppsala University in 1743, the famous Swedish professor Samuel Klingenstierna declared that the state should censor three types of dangerous books: those harmful to good morals, those harmful to the state, and above all, those harmful to religion. When in 1766 the Swedish Parliament abolished pre-publication censorship, it duly exempted religious and academic texts. Still, the Parliament's move was exceedingly progressive by its time. It may surprise some of you to learn that Denmark was so repressive that the English ambassador to Denmark, the Whig Robert Molesworth, used the kingdom as the archetype of despotic government, inimical to liberty and limited government, in his account of Denmark from the 1690s. But since Molesworth's work became one of the most widely read and influential books among the American founding fathers, I guess Danish absolutism and Orthodox Lutheranism was good for something. But in Denmark, everything changed overnight when the enlightened German doctor Johann Struensee took control and ruled the kingdom in the name of the batshit crazy King Christian VII in 1770 and made Denmark the first state in European history to implement absolute freedom of the press. Finally, Denmark surpassed the Swedes in a move celebrated in a letter to the king by Voltaire himself. But easy come, easy go. Struensee quickly became the victim of his own idealism as disgruntled citizens used the unrestricted press to launch a relentless smear campaign against Struensee, which helped undermine him and ultimately costing him both his power and his head. And as soon as the doctor was gone, many of the enlightened reforms were rolled back. Before the Swedes upped their game, the German states took third place with a consumption of 99.7 books and pamphlets per 1,000 German every year between 1701 and 1750. By 1700, the German town of Leipzig alone housed 18 publishers and booksellers. Not bad for a city of 28,000 souls. In the German states, censorship was mainly carried out by the individual princely or city governments, but also by a joint imperial book commission, which mainly scanned the large book market in Frankfurt for illegal imported books. And in the 17th century, the authorities cracked down hard on any such illegal books found, and the Germans had to import their erotica in illegal philosophy, theology, or science from the Dutch dark web. Only a few controversial books appeared in German bookshops before 1700. Things changed dramatically when Frederick the Great assumed the throne and turned Prussia into the powerhouse of Germany, as we'll see in a future episode. The secularist self-proclaimed philosopher king erased religious censorship and introduced a fair amount of intellectual freedom in the Prussian universities. But he still maintained a firm grip on the political censorship in an autocratic and highly militarized Prussian society. As we shall see, even an intellectual superstar like Immanuel Kant wasn't entirely free to live up to his own motto and dare to know. In this regard, Frederick's Prussia was emblematic for the way censorship developed in the 18th century. Less religious censorship, a bit more intellectual freedom, but still a lot of political censorship. As mentioned, Catholic states were generally a lot more tightly controlled when it comes to censorship than the Protestant frontrunners in Europe. The Italian peninsula lagged just behind France with an annual consumption of almost 50 books and pamphlets per 1,000 Italian in the early 18th century. And in the 17th and 18th centuries, the popes and their inquisitors fought a tough but ultimately losing battle with the enlightened ideas gushing forth from the Netherlands, Britain, and France. The Inquisition in Naples cracked down on the new fad by putting a number of Cartesians on trial for illegal atheism in the 1680s. In 1693, the Spinozist philosopher Di Capua called for freedom to philosophize. Consequently, the inquisitors banned his book. But by the 1750s, papal censorship had lost age-old Catholic strongholds like Venice, Naples, and Tuscany. But even in Italy, censorship turned more secular, although the Catholic Church did not give up attempts to govern speech and stem the tide of enlightenment. But where the Holy Office, Inquisition, and Congregation of the Index lost jurisdiction, the Church turned to less restrictive methods of control, including persuasion and propaganda, in order to ensure the conformity of the faithful. Spain lagged far behind France and Italy in terms of book production and consumption. Once the Spanish monarchy lost its status as the leading superpower of the world, it kept on falling, also, and quite dramatically, in terms of book production. The Spanish bookshops went from producing a third of Europe's books in the 10th century to a meager 2% in the 17th and 18th centuries. By then, Spanish book production was only a fourth of the production in Italy and an eighth of the book production in France. But even as shadows of their former glory, the Spanish readers consumed almost four times as many books as the average Portuguese. Outside the papal states, The Iberian Peninsula was the last bastion of ecclesiastical censorship. But even here, as in the rest of Europe, control of the censorship machinery slowly slipped into secular hands from the once mighty Iberian Inquisitions that had been so effective in controlling literature in both the Old and New World, as we saw in episode 17. Though in Portugal, the slow turn from ecclesiastical to secular censorship sometimes resulted in a kind of worst of both worlds scenario, with ecclesiastical and secular censors complementing each other. The Austrian Empire didn't do better than Portugal in terms of book production and consumption. Since the early 17th century, a Jesuit task force had been entrusted with policing bookshops and universities for dangerous Protestantism. But as in neighboring Prussia, the empire experienced a dramatic change when an enlightened ruler assumed the throne. Even if she was also a devout Catholic, the enlightened Empress Maria Theresa kicked the Jesuits out of the censorship office when they tried to follow Rome's lead and ban Montesquieu. The Empress instead agreed to transfer control of censorship to a new secular state commission, which gave the green light to Montesquieu, Newton, Locke, Leibniz, and other moderate Enlightenment thinkers. But Hume, Diderot, and Spinoza were banned along with eroticism, naturalism, and other types of filth. The French read surprisingly few books and pamphlets before 1750. Only consuming an annual 59 books and pamphlets per 1,000 Frenchmen in the early 18th century. Less than half the consumption of the average Briton and almost 7 times less than the average Dutchman. And as we shall see in a future episode, French censorship was elaborate. Under the Sun King Louis XIV, there were frequent book burnings as well as bookshop raids and edicts banning particular books. You'll remember the radical philosopher Pierre Bayle escaping to Rotterdam with a copy of Pensées diverses in his luggage after the book was denied publication. Or when Bayle's Encyclopédic Dictionnaire was banned from all of France in 1697. The censorship relaxed a bit after the Sun King died in 1750. But after 1750, French book production and consumption exploded as France became the vanguard of the so-called High Enlightenment. As we'll see in later episodes, French censorship continued to be multi-layered and complex, which created both opportunities and very real dangers for daring philosophes. Though even among these, we'll see marked differences in attitudes to just how free expression should really be. We'll meet Voltaire, who thought that free speech was a great idea, at least for the 1% learned, which happened to include himself, but was unsure whether 99% of the people could handle the responsibility of free speech, and so perhaps should let him do the thinking and talking for them. We'll also clear up one of history's most pervasive and misleading quote misattributions and determine if Voltaire really was willing to die for his opponent's right to disagree. Others, including Montesquieu, favored a broader protection of free speech, and some fought actively back against censorship and religious bigotry as France and Paris became the capital of the Enlightenment around the mid-18th century. Not least thanks to perhaps the most brilliant group of minds ever to assemble under one roof, in Baron d'Holbach's Salon Rue Royale in Paris. Here, some of the most radical minds of the Enlightenment congregated, including regulars such as Holbach, D'Alembert, Diderot, Raynal, and Helvétius, but also a host of other international thinkers like David Hume, Cesare Beccaria, Adam Smith, Edward Gibbon, Benjamin Franklin, and even good old John Wilkes. Diderot would have several run-ins with the law, spending time in prison and having his extremely ambitious attempt of collecting all the knowledge of mankind in the Encyclopédie banned in the 1750s. It may actually surprise you to learn that the Russian Empress Catherine the Great legalized the French encyclopedia before the French authorities. Oh, and we'll also encounter the odd man out among the philosophes in Rue Royale, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who would come to loathe and envy his former philosoph friends, and just about everyone else, and whose conception of freedom included censorship to ensure compliance with the general will, and the death penalty for violating the tenets of his homemade civic religion. The French Revolution was the culmination of the Enlightenment, for good and bad. And in a later episode, we'll explore how from early on the question of the limits of free speech was deeply divisive to the revolutionaries who toppled the ancient regime and ushered in the French Revolution. and how the burning question of free speech and press freedom became weaponized and the shifting limits a tool of deadly terror as the revolution spiraled out of control, causing even Tom Paine to call for censorship. The descent of the revolution into terror, wars on all fronts, and general chaos paved the way for Napoleon, who was in favor of free speech, as long as those who exercised this right were in favor of him. So as you can see from this brief outline, we have a lot of ground to cover, and we'll start in earnest in the next episode called Throne and Altar.